If you got a Bible, turn with me to Judges chapter 6. If you don't have a Bible, that's not a problem. We're actually thrilled to be able to say, please don't leave this building without one, because if you just go to the info center, we will make sure you get a copy of God's Word that you can read throughout the week, not just on a Sunday morning here with us. Gideon, for most people, I suspect, is very little more than the label on a Bible that you used to see in a hotel room. And maybe not even so much anymore. And I would suspect if I walked out onto the street and just said to someone, do you know what a Gideon is? They would probably say something like, I don't know what or who that is. Which is a shame. Because in the heart now of the book of Judges, his story takes 3 chapters, and it's an incredible, incredible story. And we're actually going to spend 3 weeks on this. It's going to be not interrupted because we knew this was coming. Next week, Paul Chamberlain's here. I'm thrilled. He was my favorite prof in university. I'm always excited to be able to listen to him. But we're going to do an overview this week of all 3 chapters. And then after Paul, come back for 2 weeks and look in depth at a few pieces of this story. So that's kind of our plan today. So that by the time we're done, we know more than just a name on a Bible. We maybe even know because obviously we're not just out in the streets. Many of us grew up in Sunday school and stuff. And probably we know some stories of Gideon. Maybe the laying out of the fleece kind of story. It's like, how do you know the will of God? Well, you do what Gideon did, right? He laid out a fleece, whatever that meant. And then he prayed and God did something. And then he knew what to do next, right? And so for many of us, that's the takeaway of Gideon. Some of us know a little bit more of the 300. That somehow Gideon goes up against an insurmountable army. And it has something to do with drinking water. But we're not sure. Like who drank and how they drank and why that mattered. But probably that's about it. And I don't mean that as an insult, because in all honesty, aside from really digging in over the last couple months, if you had said, here's a quiz on Gideon and offered it to me, I probably would have failed. Because there is so much more to this story that we don't often tell. And that's sort of my goal this morning, is to tell the rest of the story. Just before we jump in, I want to just remind you, though, of what we've been talking about through the book of Judges, this cycle that's going on. And if you're visiting, this will get you up to speed really quick. Here's the plot line of the book of Judges that just goes over and over and over. It starts with the people sin. Then there's a foreign oppressor. Then they cry out to God. Then God, in his mercy and grace, sends a judge. That's the name of the sort of the title given to these people who will deliver. And that judge delivers. And during their lifetime, so during the life, I'll give a number 4, number 5. During the life of the judge, there is rest. Then the judge dies, and we repeat the whole thing. And we're about 3 big cycles of this into the story. So we had Othniel, he was the first. It's the shortest story. It just kind of gets right to this kind of plot line. It's like, they sinned, there was oppressors, they cried out, God sent a judge, he brought rest to the land, and within about 3 verses, we get the plot line. Then we moved on to Ehud, that's the second big story, and you get more detail, right? You get names and places, and you get a description of how this man delivered, and then you kind of get more sort of window dressing around it, so you kind of get this whole story. And then Ehud dies, and then we get right back to sin. And then I don't know if you noticed, but last week in the big cycle, we now have the people sinning, and we get an oppressor again, and they cry out, and then Deborah is sent by the Lord. She is a judge, and she comes along, and with the help of Barak and Jael, there's deliverance. But there's a piece that's left out right here. There is rest in the land, but there's no reference to this lasting as long as Deborah dies. In fact, there's no reference at all to her death. It's just sort of the first moment where if we're really paying careful attention, we go, oh, there's a piece in this that kind of got dropped. And I mention that because as we go through Gideon's story, I just want you to kind of pay attention to this, because I'll give you the spoiler alert here. There's going to be pieces of this now that through Gideon's own life start to get dropped. This nice, neat plot line is going to get a little murky for us, and I think that's part of the point. So I'm going to pick up in chapter 6, verse 1, where it says, "The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them over into the hand of Midian for 7 years." So we're kind of back to this beginning point. The people did what was evil, they sinned, and as a result, there's a foreign oppressor. Now Midian, interesting enough, wasn't always a foreign oppressor. In fact, when Moses ran from Pharaoh way back before the Exodus and all those things, if you remember, he goes to Midian. These are the people that he actually becomes part of them. He's living with them and they're good to him. They don't sort of turn until the Exodus itself. The people are in the wilderness, and it's the Midianites who are trying to get Israel to turn from the Lord, from faithfulness to him, and they're trying to get them to worship foreign gods. And from that point on, the Midianites and the Israelites are now sort of playing on two different teams. By the time we get to where we're at historically, we've got the Israelites as settlers, so they've settled down in the land of Israel that we would know as Canaan in the Bible times. And the Midianites are a nomadic people. They don't really have a home. They just sort of travel. They've got camels. That's sort of the cutting edge technology. And through the story, even that shows up. So they're traveling around. And at this point, all of a sudden, because of the evil of the Israelites, God gives them over into the hands of the Midianites. It's different than some of the other oppressors from the other plot lines. The Midianites don't just move in and take over. They just visit. They swoop in with their camels. They take what they want, and then they leave again. And it seems like for 7 years, every year they do this. The Israelites grow crops, they grow what they need to survive, the Midianites come and take them. And the irony of it is the Israelites now are going to be described more like nomads. They don't have homes, they're hiding, they're living in caves, but they're supposed to be the settlers. They're supposed to be the ones settled down. And the Midianites, who are the nomads, are coming and eating the crops that have been cultivated. And I think what Judges 6 is showing us is just how backwards everything is becoming as a consequence of the sin of Israel. The part that Israel, I don't think, gets is that this and this, these two parts of the story could also be called sort of the breaking of the covenant and then the covenant curses. Because that's really what sin boiled down to. God said, we're going to have a relationship. Here's the basis of the relationship. It's all through Deuteronomy laid out for them. And if you follow me, I'm going to bless you. And if you don't, there's going to be very specific results. And I mention that because the results are spelled out in absolute stunning, shocking detail. At least for us who can open to Deuteronomy 28 and read what the specific cursings were going to be. I mean, it's spelled out even down to the animals that are going to be taken. If you look at verse 4, they're going to take the sheep, the ox, and the donkeys. Go read Deuteronomy 28, and God says, look, if you break the covenant, I'm going to take away your ox, your sheep, and your donkeys. I mean, Israel should have been going, oh, wow. We realize what's happened. We've broken the covenant. We see clearly because it's being spelled out so specifically, but they don't. They just don't seem to notice any of it, and that sadly seems to be a good lesson for the human heart. I don't notice. In fact, often I do exactly what Gideon's going to do when things go awry and there's consequence to sin. I don't look and go, maybe I should learn. Maybe I should examine my own heart. Instead, I do what Gideon is going to do a few verses later. Is what's wrong with God? Why has God abandoned us? Never assuming that maybe it was me abandoning him. It's always his problem. Gideon's going to get there very quickly. But for the first 6 verses, we get this picture of what's going on in the land of Israel, the sin and the oppression. And it ends with verse 6, this statement, "And Israel was brought very low because of Midian." They were crushed. Literally, it says something, they were made small. Just what looked like it should have been a significant nation is now being crushed under the weight of a foreign oppressor. Now that's the beginning of the story. That's kind of the first couple steps. And so let me ask you this. When they cry out as they're about to, what's supposed to happen next? A judge, right? That's how the story works. And here's where it gets interesting. Verse 6. "And Israel was brought low because of Midian, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord to help. When the people of Israel cried out to the Lord on account of the Midianites," verse 8, "the Lord sent a prophet." A prophet? The Lord's supposed to send a judge. Doesn't he know kind of the plot line of the story that he's constructed? He sends a deliverer because they cry out, and this time he sends a judge, and the judge says, the prophet says, "On behalf of the Lord, I led you up from Egypt. I brought you out of the house of slavery. I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of all who oppressed you. I drove them out before you. I gave you their land. And I said to you, I'm the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. If we were to stop there, as I've tried to kind of discipline my thoughts this week, here's what I think we would feel. Having been an Israelite, if you were an Israelite just having heard that message, you would probably assume, oh boy, we're in trouble now. It feels like the Lord's done saving us. No judge this time. Just a reminder that we've blown it. He had saved us. He saved us before. He now has come and told us that we've not listened to his word. And right at that moment where you think like maybe the justice or mercy of God is starting to evaporate, verse 11 comes. The angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abiezerite, while his son Gideon was beating out the wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. And the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor. And Gideon said, sir, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? And now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian. It reminds me of that story. And the mom who's telling her little girl all the great Bible stories of how God delivered and David and Goliath and all the great ones of God working. And the little girl said to her, turns to her mom afterwards and says, sounds like God was a lot more exciting back then. You ever felt that? You open the Bible and say, where's that? Because we've trained our eyes not to see his work. That's Gideon's answer. The angel comes and his answer is, why and where? Why is this happening? Why isn't the Lord saving us? And where are all his wondrous deeds? We know them. But his answer isn't, hey, maybe this is a clue that we've done something. Maybe this should be a clue that we've abandoned the Lord. You see Gideon's conclusion? The Lord's abandoned us. But in that is this really odd statement, which I don't know if anyone totally knows what to do with. Oh, Gideon, mighty man of valor. The irony is the man is hiding. He's threshing wheat in a wine press. That's not how you thresh wheat. You thresh wheat sort of on a high place, the top of the hill where the wind can blow, and you kind of thresh it and you break the chaff and the wheat. And there's different ways that they would do it, sort of bigger versions using animals and stuff. But it looks like Gideon's now hiding in a wine press, threshing out the meager little wheat he's got. He is far, far, at least to the human eye, from being any sort of valor or might. The guy's a coward. I don't blame him. I would have been in the wine, I might not even been in the wine press. I might have been hiding somewhere. But the Lord shows up, as we're going to see. This is not just an angel. This is actually going to be the Lord himself, as we'll discover in a moment. And the Lord sees something different. Sometimes I wonder if we do too much what Gideon does. Is I'm just weak. I'm no one. I'm not sufficient. I'm the least from the least to the clans. And the Lord looks and says, yeah, but the point never was how powerful you were. The point was always, as Paul knew, that when the Lord is working through you, you become a mighty man and a mighty woman. Because it's him. It's his strength. It's his ability working in us. Gideon doesn't see that yet. He will. He'll come. That's the beginning point for Gideon. It's not a great start. He arrives at this moment, a coward. The Lord comes. He questions the Lord. He doubts the Lord. He accuses the Lord. And then this interesting moment. He puts the Lord, the angel, to the test. He begins to seem to realize that there's more going on here than first met the eye. In fact, sort of the Lord kind of revealed himself a little bit to him through this conversation. And Gideon suddenly realizes that this is a pretty significant moment. And so he does something. He suggests a test of sort. It's a strange test. He says to the angel of the Lord, who he now is starting to come to understand is maybe more than even just a messenger. He says, you stay here. I'm going to go make supper. And he goes away. We're not sure how long, but from some of the measurements, it's not just that he whipped away and 5 minutes later grabbed some stuff out of the fridge and came back with kind of like an instant meal. The loaf of bread he makes, he actually uses 35 pounds of flour. Remember, we're at a time of famine. They don't have anything. These people are starving to death. It's almost more of the picture is he goes home and finds everything he can and brings it as a gift slash test of this messenger who's come to see him. Verse 19, Gideon went into his house, prepared a young goat and unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, the broth he put in a pot. He brought them under the terebinth and presented them. And the angel of God said, take the meat and the unleavened cakes, put them on the rock and pour the broth over them. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord reached out the tip of his staff that was in his hand, touched the meat and the unleavened cakes, and fire sprang up from the rock. Get the picture? Rocks don't burn. Fire springs out from the rock and consumes it all. And the angel of the Lord vanishes from his sight. Verse 22, then Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. And Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for now I've seen the angel of the Lord face to face. Kind of an interesting thing. You almost wish Gideon could have remembered what that moment actually meant. That when you offer a sacrifice, because the meal became a sacrifice the second God showed up and touched it. When you offer a sacrifice to God and when it ignites like that, that's a sign of the Lord's favor. But Gideon can't see through that yet. All he knows now is that this angel of the Lord is actually the Lord and he's seen him face to face, and now his instinct is fear. Just fear. And it's actually going to take the Lord coming back to him in verse 23 and saying, peace to you, don't fear, you will not die. For Gideon to bring him back to that spot where he's able to come to grips with what's just taken place. And as a result, he decides to build an altar. The altar is going to be called something about the peace of the Lord. And in other words, Gideon recognizes he should have died, but God's been good to him, and now there's peace. And so he builds this altar. It's not really described how big, but he builds it. And here's where the story takes its first sort of turn. On a place that we're going to discover is next to the altar that his dad had built to Baal. You go, hold on a second. What's happened to this Israelite family that they have descended this low? That they're actually worshiping Baal. In fact, it looks like probably the day before when Gideon went to worship, it wasn't the Lord he was worshiping. If he went with his family, it was Baal he was worshiping. And now we start to realize we have a problem. We have a massive problem. And I think while it's not spelled out, the things that Gideon is about to learn go something like this, that before the Lord will deliver you and save you, you've got to deal with the Baals of your heart. It's one thing to call out to the Lord and say, Lord, Lord, save me. But until you've made Jesus Lord, I'm not sure how much we can assume that God's going to answer that. He does in grace at times, but it's like the Lord comes to Gideon and says, Gideon, the first thing we're going to deal with is the idols in your backyard. We got to deal with that stuff, Gideon, before you lead people, before you save nations. And if there is an application there, I don't know what is, because there's been too many people over the years who have gone off to change the world, who forgot first to deal with what was going on in their own hearts. The Lord comes to Gideon and says, okay, Gideon, here's what we're going to do. Tonight, you're going to go. Well, actually, he doesn't say tonight. He just says, you're going to go and destroy the altar. Your dad's altar that he built. Just for an idea of how big this is, the one that they have excavated further north of this was 24 feet square and 4.5 feet high. So these are big. So when we read the description of God saying, Gideon, take your dad's prized ox. It's a 7-year-old. Every description of it means that this is the prized animal. Take that animal, destroy the altar to Baal, and then cut down the pole next to it that was used to worship Asherah. And then I want you to chop up the pole, which is kind of ironic because Gideon's name actually means chopper. So chopper, chop down this thing. Then once you've destroyed this and you've built an altar, then you cut up the lumber, put the lumber on it, then take your dad's prized oxen, butcher it, and offer it as a sacrifice. Gideon says, okay, but I'm going to do it at night. I'll go along. Isn't that interesting obedience? I've obeyed God sometimes at night. You know what I mean by that? Like, okay, God, I'm going to do this, but I will do it in the most hidden, veiled way possible so that I can still say I obeyed, but I tried to hold back a little bit. I wonder if in the middle of the night, though, that Gideon's thoughts kind of got revealed, because I'm not sure how you offer a sacrifice on a fire without actually making it the most visible thing in the neighborhood at the highest point. I kind of wonder if Gideon just didn't see that thing all the way through. But we do know that by morning, in verse 28, the man of the town who rose early, and it's interesting, isn't it, that the worshipers of Baal are getting up to do their morning devotions? Kind of maybe shame on us for those moments where we've forgotten, but they're up, they rose early. And what's on their mind is their altar, and they go and they discover it's been broken down, it's been cut down, and they conclude that they must put the man to death who's broken down their idol, which again is such a sad statement on the nation of Israel. Idol breakers and destroyers should be the one who are honored. The idol worshipers, if anyone's going to get destroyed, it's them. And now we have this whole confusing, messed up thing where these are Israelites worshiping Baal, wanting to put to death their fellow Israelite who has destroyed the idol. And then the man who we wonder whether he will become the great problem for Gideon steps forward. It's his dad. Remember the owner of the ox, the builder of the altar? He steps forward and he says something like this: look, if Baal is real, why don't we just trust that Baal will deal with Gideon? Kind of the same sort of thing shows up in the New Testament a few times. Reminds me of John Knox's story. He was, because of his preaching, he'd been made a slave in a ship rowing. This is years and years and years ago, Reformation times. And one day the slave masters came onto the boat. These are all, they're not criminals. They were criminals only because they preached the gospel, and they were trying to make them kiss a statue of Mary. This is John Knox's turning point. And he refuses. He's not going to kiss it. He's not going to honor or venerate that. That's kind of what that meant to them. And he takes it and he throws it over the edge of the ship. And he basically says to them, if Mary is so great, let her save herself from drowning. And the stick sinks, and they all sort of look and go, now we don't know what to do. And John Knox goes on and leads the Reformation in Scotland. It's kind of that moment for Gideon. He's destroyed the altar, and his dad steps up and says, if Baal is as powerful as we have thought, let's let him deal with the justice. I think his dad knows at this point, I don't know if it's just been a prick in his conscience, where all of a sudden he realizes he has veered so far from what was right. And it's interesting to me that the man who seems like he might be the greatest problem for Gideon becomes one of his greatest allies, his own dad. And it's a reminder to me that when I get in situations that seem difficult and I'm tempted to put the label on someone of enemy or adversary, to be really careful with that, because in God's great providence, that very person might end up becoming the very person that someday he moves alongside me as the greatest ally, because God can still transform hearts. Now, that episode seems now to get us ready that Gideon would now go and deliver his people. That seems to be the next step, right? Remember, the Midianites are still there, and by the time we get to verse 33, that seems to be kind of the point in the story. The Midianites now kind of arrive back on the scene. It's springtime. They've crossed the Jordan. They've encamped in the valley of Jezreel. And the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. That is a brilliant description. It actually is, here's what it actually literally says. It's like the Spirit of the Lord is there and he took Gideon and put him on like his clothes. Isn't that brilliant? And in the Old Testament, we see descriptions of the Holy Spirit, but all of it's limited. And we'll come back to this point probably in one of those two Sundays where we have more time. The extent is limited. Just the Spirit comes on a few. The duration is limited. The purpose is limited. Then we hit the New Testament. And the great change is that the Holy Spirit of God comes upon all believers forever, and not just for a narrow purpose, but for all sorts of wonderful purposes. And there's this massive change, and we're clothed. We speak of being clothed with the Spirit, but did you get that language? It's like, no, the Spirit says, I just put you on so that I can work through you. Gideon now is going to be used by the Spirit. He sends out word to all the nation, not quite all the nation, come back to that maybe, to most of the nation to come. We're going to go to battle against the Midianites, and this great transformation happens, and the only thing we can see is that Midian stood up to the altar, and now the Holy Spirit's come upon him, and those two factors alone are enough that an entire nation says, we'll follow him. Don't ever minimize the power of the Spirit to work. I guess that's the lesson of that brief moment. Because I can't see any other reason why people all of a sudden decide to follow Gideon. He's still the fearful guy who's, remember, just been hiding. He's never fought a battle. Now he says, follow me. He actually will say that later. When they're actually going into battle, he says, look at me and do what I do. I'm like, Gideon, how many times have you fought in a war? I'm like, well, never, but just follow me. And they do. And I think the main explanation is the Spirit of God. Now, before he goes to battle, Gideon has one issue. He's still afraid. And here comes this fleece story. And the story goes something like this. Gideon puts the Lord to the test. He actually calls it a test, I think, in verse 39. He's honest, at least, what he's doing. We're told we're not supposed to put the Lord to the test, but Gideon puts the Lord to the test. It's this strange thing. We sort of use it as sort of an example of maybe this is how you figure out the will of the Lord. This one we're definitely coming back to one of those two Sundays, because let me just make sure you understand. This is not how you determine the will of the Lord. This is actually how you display your doubt in the Lord. That's what Gideon's doing here. And he's going to do it twice. And the only amazing part in the whole thing is that God just doesn't, I don't know what, strike him with fire and turn him into an ox. The only amazing thing is that the Lord actually does it. I think it's I can't remember off the top of my head. Anyway, I'll try to come up with that one when we're back in it. The Lord actually entertains this. So Gideon's idea is, okay, God, if you're real, and if you're actually with me, and if you're going to do what you promised multiple times you would do, which God had at this point, I'm going to put a fleece out at night, and when I wake up in the morning, if all the ground is dry but the fleece is wet, then I'll know that you're with me. And so he does that, and the Lord does his part, and he wakes up in the morning, the fleece is wet, and you would think Gideon would say, wow, God in his mercy answered my prayer. But actually Gideon realizes, I asked for the wrong sign. Because if you go home tonight, maybe not tonight, but if the conditions are right, and you put out a towel on your picnic table, probably in the morning, if there's dew on anything, it's on the towel. In fact, in these days, in sort of these kind of conditions, that's often how they gathered water. They put out fleeces at night, and then in the morning they wrung them out into a cup, and you had water because that got wet, the ground stayed dry. It's just how things work. It's almost like Gideon's probably done that before, so he kind of knew that, and then realizes the next morning, it's like, well, that wasn't actually miraculous enough, so God, here's what we're going to do. Plan B is tomorrow I'm going to put out the fleece. Now I want the ground to be wet and the fleece to be dry. And God does it. We'll come back to that. But be careful with that as some sort of interpretive lesson of here's how you figure out the will of God. God is much more concerned with us walking with him, having godly wisdom that's informed by his word, rather than signs and miraculous fleeces and drying and doors and openings. And I've done it. I'll just be honest. Lord, if you want me to do this next Tuesday, please make the phone ring. That's my fleece kind of things, right? You ever done those kind of things? Rather than saying, Lord, I trust you. You're going to lead me. You've given me your word. I know its principles. I'm just amazed at how merciful God is. Verse 40, there it is. And God did so that night, and it was dry, and the fleece only, the ground was dew. So now we would expect Gideon's ready to go and lead them into battle. Only one thing, God still knows Gideon is a fearful man. And so there's still some issues to resolve. And so God's going to do that very thing, I'm going to suggest to you, by actually weakening him. God's going to give him assurance by almost crippling him. The first thing God has to do is deal with the numbers. The Midianites have something that's like 135,000, something like that. Basically, it's like the stars of the sea. It's actually interesting, that description, because that's the stars of the sea is the stars of the sky is the description given to Abraham's offspring. Now, when the Israelites look on the Midianites, they're using the same language to describe their enemies. And God says, yeah, we have a math problem. You've got, 32,000 men. They've got over 130,000. You're outnumbered 4-1. This isn't going to work. We need to get rid of some of your men, Gideon, so that everyone knows that when you win this victory, it was the Lord. And so the first announcement is anyone who's afraid goes home. I wonder in Gideon's mind, I mean, that's his story. He's a fearful man. I think the Lord's at work in that moment. Most of the men leave, about two-thirds. Gideon's now left with his much diminished army, and God says that's still too many. People still might get confused, 10,000 versus 130-something thousand. So he says, here's the next thing. I want them to drink. So there's a spring there. And he says, based on how they drink, we're going to send more home. Textually, this is a really odd one. In fact, different translations, some of you will be even reading out of them, and you'll be going, hold on a second, mine says something different. The problem with the story is it's not totally clear whether the people who lap the water like dogs also do something with their hands, or whether that's a separate issue. But here's what it boils down to. Some lap water out of the stream like a dog, and others sort of cup it out with their hands. Most do that with their hands, 300 lap out. Now, I don't know, have you ever been hiking? I've hiked a bit. I've drunk water out of streams. I'm not sure it's always the safest, but you're up, you know, high, and you kind of go, it's probably not contaminated, no bacteria, we'll risk it this time. I have never been tempted to get down on my hands and knees and start sucking water out of a stream. That just, to me, seems odd. Now, if you have, this is not an insult to you. So yeah. But I think it's strange. And I think what this means is that Gideon is left with 300 guys who have chosen to drink in an unusual way that the rest of the world would look on and go, that's unusual. He's not left with the 300 bravest or the cleverest or the men of valor. God has crippled Gideon with 300 guys who decide the best way to drink out of a puddle when the army is just over there. The enemy is like right over there. Let's get our faces down in there. And God says, perfect. Now Gideon, you and these 300 men, this is perfect. Now I can work. Now Gideon, one more thing, because I know you're still afraid. I'm going to do one more thing for you. I'm going to let you go down into the enemy camp, get really close so you can see how many of them there are, and I'm going to let you hear one more thing. That's what the next part of the story is. Gideon goes with his sidekick. They go down into the enemy camp. Again, to his eyes, this is overwhelming. And remember, God often takes us into dangerous, difficult things to give us assurance. It's not to scare us. It's actually to assure us of his faithfulness and his goodness. Gideon arrives right as two Midianites are talking about a dream one of them had, and the dream's just this. I had a dream last night, and a large barley bun came rolling down the hill. It hit our tent and knocked it over. And the other guy says, oh, I know what that means. That means Gideon, and they've obviously spied enough to know who Gideon is and his army. That means Gideon and his men are going to beat us. I don't know how you get from a bun hitting a tent, and we're outnumbered, you know, there's 300 of them and 130,000. How you go there other than the Lord? See the Lord's grace in this? And he's already putting in the hearts of the Midianites this fear that's totally unreasonable. The battle happens. For those of you who don't know, the way it works is Gideon and his men don't even use swords. Even though they yell, a sword for the Lord and a sword for Gideon, no one's actually got a sword. They've got clay pots with torches inside and trumpets. They surround the Midianites in the middle of the night. They shatter their clay pots. They blow their trumpets. And the Midianites don't know what's going on and pretty much kill almost all of them. And the Lord wins this great victory. And right there is a perfect spot for the story to have stopped. And we should read the statement that says, and the land had rest for however many years until Gideon died, and unfortunately, the story doesn't end. And if you allow me 5 more minutes, I'll bring it to an ending. And then, like I said, we'll be able to come back. Gideon pursues the men who retreat, 15,000 of them with his 300 men. He crosses the Jordan in pursuit of them. It seems haywire. And interesting enough, from this point on, there's very little mention of the Lord in this. The one time Gideon actually brings up God very plainly, I think it's chapter 8, verse 2 or 3, he actually doesn't even use the name Lord. He doesn't use the covenant personal name. He uses the name Elohim, the generic name of God. I think it's our clue that something is going on within Gideon. Gideon's gone from a fearful man to this courageous man that God uses. But the progression hasn't stopped. Something is going seriously wrong in his heart. And there's two or three stories, we won't have time for all of them here this morning, that indicate it. The most tragic is he goes to his own fellow countrymen on the other side of the Jordan, asking them for help as he chases down the rest of the army, and they won't help. And he says, then I'm going to come back, and I will enact revenge upon you. He eventually goes with his 300 guys. He destroys what's left of the Midianites' army. It's a tragic scene. He comes back and he destroys one of those cities, puts to death countless men, his own countrymen. And then he brings these kings, the two Midianite kings that he's captured, and he sets up his son. He says, now, son, I want you to kill them. We learn along the way that the Midianites have actually killed off most of Gideon's brothers. That this is actually revenge. This isn't a righteous obedience to the Lord. This is now Gideon's heart that has been longing for the blood of his enemies. He tries to get his son to do it. And everything in that description pictures his son exactly like Gideon was before all this happened. Innocent, fearful, weak, unable to do this. And he won't do it. And if ever there's a hero in the story, I think it's Gideon's son. Gideon asks him essentially to become a Canaanite. There's no honor for an Israelite to do that. There's no instruction that that's how they were to act. That's how the Gideons act. Or not the Gideons. Don't quote me on that one. We'll put second service message on. The Gideons don't act like that. They're a very noble group. They put Bibles in hotels. But his son won't do it. Gideon does. Then they come to him and say, Gideon, we want to make you king because you've done this great thing for us. And Gideon says, Israel already has a king. His name is the Lord. I won't be king. But his actions say something completely different. The story will end of him taking numerous wives and concubines, which is what the kings did. The story will end of him taking the plunder of the battle, which is what kings do. The story will end with him naming his son, my father is king. Which is what kings name their sons. And Gideon will build an ephod, some sort of garment that's used to determine the will of the Lord. He'll make his own and set it up at his house. And by the time all is said and done, we don't have this. For the rest of the life of the judge, there is rest. Instead, we have the judge himself leading the nation to worship an idol. There's a lot in this story we're going to come back to. There are some profound things. But if I could leave one thing with you, it would be this. When Hebrews 11 tells the story of these great men and women of faith, and they are great, and Gideon's included in it. He's listed in it. The story doesn't end in chapter 11. The story doesn't end with, look at these great heroes of faith and somehow hold them up and venerate them or honor them or even imitate them. The story continues into Hebrews chapter 12 and tells us we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, yes. And then it goes on to the very passage that Mark read for us this morning as we were worshiping. Therefore, in light of all of this, fix your eyes on Jesus. Not on a judge, not on a person. Fix your eyes on the Son of God who never fails, who delivers perfectly. Put your hope in Him, your trust in Him, because He will deliver us and lead us. And He will ultimately bring us into the presence of His Heavenly Father with great joy.